Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
With Renault's award-winning hybrid and full electric lineup, where style meets tech. Rethink Renault.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we'll hear from the Chief Technology and Transformation Officer at the HSE about the app that looks to streamline how we interact with our health service. And as ever, later in the show, I will answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can do so right now. TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address. Or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. We have plenty to get to over the next wee while, so I want to jump straight in this week with that HSE app. As we've spoken about numerous times on this programme, technology has a huge role to play in how our health service works, from keeping well people well for longer to reducing pressure on the system as a whole. A significant stepping stone in that journey is the HSE Health app, which you can download right now if you want on both iOS and Android. Damian McCallion is the Chief Technology and Transformation Officer and Deputy CEO of the HSE, and he joins me now. Damian, it's great to have you on the show. Can you just start by telling us from a broad point of view, what is the core function of this app?
Yeah, so maybe I'll start by saying the app is one of our key elements of our digital for care strategy. And there's a couple of pieces to that. One is the app which patients and the public can interact with the health system on. Another is our electronic health record program, which is called the One Health Record, which we're currently going through procurement for, which will be the system that will be used to do a lot of the work for our staff and support our staff across hospitals and community. And lastly, then, in terms of the third leg of this, is around what we call our shared record, which is essentially like a digital copy. If you remember your chart in a hospital, and for patients who have a lot of interaction, it's like a digital copy of that chart, and it includes hospital and community information, but it's just a digital snapshot. So the app is really the public-facing engagement with the health system. It's a single location for the public where they'll be able to interact with healthcare. It's a trusted location. It uses the government ID, which is used for lots of other services as well. And currently we've around over 300,000 people have downloaded the app, and around 200,000 are using that actively in terms of through their MyGov ID. You can access some of the features without the security, just information. Mm-hmm. And ultimately we would see it as being the solution of choice where we will try and direct communications to the public while recognising, Jess, and this is really important, we have a responsibility to all aspects of society. And we know there are some groups that perhaps aren't as digitally well connected as others, disadvantaged areas, some marginalised groups, perhaps in some international areas we know where there's less interaction historically with digital, with healthcare. So we've always got to have other mechanisms to communicate with people. But we are trying to move communications to the public through the app, largely because it's what the public want. So when HICWA do a study every year on the public's appetite, if you like, for digital health, the numbers are typically in the high 80s to 90% of people who expect and want the health service to be able to talk to them around their healthcare through digital means, be that the app or other ways of doing so, the same as you would for your bank or for other services that we all use now, book a flight, travel, and so on and so forth. Yes. So that's it. It's really going to be the trusted location of choice for the public, but it won't be the only avenue. We will have other channels to communicate, but we want to route as much as possible through that. One, it's what the public want. Two, it's also much more efficient use of taxpayers' money, and anything we can save on that can be reinvested in frontline care.
It makes perfect sense. And I think the analogy that you use there is brilliant because, you know, people can get the news on their phone, they can get it on the radio, or they can opt for the newspaper if they so wish. The information is always there, but you do have the option to get it in the palm of your hand. And that expectation now is there, particularly with certain cohorts of the Irish population. But I'm assuming and having no technical knowledge, it's much more complex building an app like this that deals with sensitive personal information that then plugs into a wider system than it would be for me to build a new News Talk app or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it's a fair comparison. I mean, health and social care, and it's important, of course, because we cover everything: mental health, disability, social inclusion, palliative care, primary care, older persons, as well as acute care. We tend to think of hospitals, but of course, our responsibility is the entire gambit of health and social care for the population of Ireland. So security and authentication and reliability is really important, and trust is important. And to be fair, the public have generally, the feedback we've had is they trust information from the HSE. One of the challenges with the wider internet now is it can often be hard to know, you know, what's real, what's partially true, and what is not true. Mm. And we've seen it even in some of the early adaptations of AI around healthcare, where it can be very powerful, but equally when it goes wrong, it has challenged us. So we have a responsibility, I guess, as the people who provide health services on behalf of the public here in Ireland, on behalf of government, that we make sure that what we put in through is secure, is safe, and gives people reliable access to information. I guess the key thing for us is we're trying to invest in what we would call the core systems that we need in our health service in order to provide that information. So one of the challenges we've had, and one of the reasons Ireland has scored so badly on digital health, has been that we haven't got those foundational systems to give you that common data that you can then present to the public, whether you live in Donegal or North Dublin or Wexford. And that is the challenge. So we have a big program called Digital for Care, which is trying to invest in, as I say, that one health record, which is the electronic health record, but also in areas like laboratories, like our primary care, to make sure they're connected in, your GPs, your pharmacists, your dentist. And in other areas like our public health areas, vaccinations and immunizations, those sort of areas as well. So we have a lot of different types of services, Jess, and we have to make sure they're all factored into this overall roadmap. And we have a lot of these programs now well underway. Some are in implementation, some are in tender stage, and they'll give the foundation information. And just as important as the solutions is that the data is consistent, so that if I get an appointment or I get pharmacy information about my drugs in Donegal, it's consistent with what I might get from St. James's. Because patients in Donegal will go to a large centre like James's or Cork or Limerick. So we have to make sure we've good standards as well. And that's really important alongside the systems. And that's what will effectively feed the app. In some ways, the app, while it has complexity around security and around presenting information to people, will only ever be as powerful as what's behind it. So some of the features we have in there at the moment, for example, we have an area called My Health, which has patient records. So because we've got a good structured chronic disease program in the community with about 500,000 people involved in that with GPs, we're able to provide that information to people. Your medicines, where they're reimbursed through our primary care reimbursement service, we've got easy access to those, so they're presented back. All your vaccines, because we have a national immunization system. All of your health cards, your medical card, your drug payment card, European health insurance card, all of those are there. And that's because we have the foundational system. So this would be a gradual evolution, Jess, in terms of information that would give you your full health record on your phone. And we've also been able to get things like, say, as we've gradually got hospitals to standardise the appointment systems, we now have several 100,000 hospital appointments been pumped out on a regular basis to the app. And that's invaluable to patients. They can put that into their calendar. It gives them their prompts and reminder, and give other information. And we want to move, instead of getting multiple letters, multiple SMSs, where patients get used to using the app as a means to see where their appointments are, get supporting information around it. And maternity is a good example. That was the first one we went live with. And the reason we were able to do that is our 6 maternity hospitals all have a full electronic health record. Mm. So that was really powerful. And then we're looking at how could you link information that we have around maternity services for women to their appointments. And one of the things we're looking at is, can we give them access directly to their own chart, directly through the app and through a portal? So where we have those good foundational systems, we can improve what we make available to the public. Other areas, Jess, we're looking on is what we call living well. So care plans, people with mental health challenges, physical activity plans, quit smoking initiative is now accessible through the app. And also things then like finding a service. So if you want to know where your nearest urgent care centre is, radiology centre and so on, or to pay a bill. So all of those services that would support patients and the public will help. So really, in summary, we're grouping them really under 4 headings. One is your health and your patient records. 2 is around all your appointments and referrals and information perhaps that you want to understand where you're at in the system. 3rdly is around care plans for people to support them in living well. And 4thly, then that piece around services, paying bills, being able to access services, understanding where they are. They're the 4 headings we see the app developing over the coming years.
Yeah, and it's brilliant to have it all anchored in one place, because as someone who, because of a loved one, has been interacting with the health service a lot over the last number of years, you do note that, you know, sometimes you'll get a letter in confirming an appointment. Sometimes it's a text. Sometimes the letter goes missing before you write it down. It just removes that layer of faff. And once you get into the system, then you're in. Was there much work in terms of bringing the hospital and the admin side of the HSE up to speed to facilitate the input of the data to the app on their end?
Yeah, if I take you through maybe the process. So we have a team that deal with the app itself, and then out around the country we have different hospital systems. Now, fortunately, a lot of our hospitals are on one system, and that made those hospitals easier once we were able to standardise the approach. So part of that was the technology, trying to make sure it's consistent. But equally, what we discovered is the way clinics were recorded in different hospitals, the work practices, the processes were different. So we also had to standardise that as part of it. So like any technology, I guess, in terms of implementation, you've got to look at the workflow and the process and the data and make sure it's standardized, because otherwise the patient who might have an appointment in Letterkenny and an appointment in James's in Dublin will see two different things, or they won't come across to them in a way that makes sense. So there was a lot of work in making sure that all of the data was cleaned up, all the clinics were structured in the right way. And the technology in some ways then, in terms of feeding that through, was not the hardest part, albeit the team, I'm sure, would say to me there was a lot of work in that, Jess. But I think the key thing is really getting all of the hospitals standardised. And we still have some of our hospitals who are on really old systems, and it's not realistic to transfer them over as we are today. They'll wait for the full electronic health record to come along before we transfer those appointments over. But we have got the majority of hospitals, and we are working with one or two of the other big ones who had, for example, James's were going through a major upgrade of their hospital system. So we've had to wait until that's completed before those appointments will come on. So it's very much an evolution. It's very gradual. Our aim, Jess, is to have three new releases every year and try and incorporate as many new features or as many new hospitals or indeed our community services. Community services, these are primary care, mental health, disability, you know, really important services for people. And that's where much of our healthcare is. Our aim is over the next couple of years to get a standard appointments type system in where those can feed through to the app, so people will have all of those appointments as well, rather than just the hospital appointments, which often, believe it or not, maybe a lot less in terms of volume and frequency for many patients than those appointments that have out there in the community services.
Mm. One thing that we've spoken about on this programme over the last number of years, and it's something that I'm very passionate about, which is keeping well people well for longer and how technology can help with that. And I'm a firm believer that information is power. So the e-health record and giving people access to their health information, in my opinion anyway, does have a part to play in that. How do you envisage it coming into force? Will it continue to be rolled out with a certain cohort of patients? Will it be done hospital by hospital, or what way will that work?
So it'll be a combination, Jess. I mean, ultimately, when we have the electronic health record right throughout the country, as places like Canada, Northern Ireland, the UK, Australia, New Zealand have at the moment, and we've looked at all of those countries and how they've rolled this out, because that's a big challenge. Mm. But as we gradually bring that on, that will open up the potential to making information available to the public through the app. The key principle, you've said it yourself, is we have to be transparent and give people access to their own information. It's their information. We will have guidelines agreed with our patient groups and with professional bodies. For example, if I'm going to get bad news and a diagnosis, I may not necessarily want to get that through an app. Clearly, I might want to talk to my clinician, my GP, my hospital specialist, mental health specialist in the community, wherever it is. So we do have to have guardrails or guidelines around that and how we make sure that sensitive information is relayed in a way that's appropriate for patients and finds that balance between getting information to us as the public and as patients and still being respectful of that clinical process that people have when they engage with our services. That's probably principle number one in terms of that transparency, but with guardrails or guidelines, whatever language you want to use around it. The way we'll build it up will be gradual. So we'll gradually bring more hospitals on, as I said, in terms of the appointments piece. We'll also start to bring more community services on, so people will have more of their appointments within the app. Then in parallel, I mentioned the chronic disease programme, so people are getting their information back who are on that programme. They're able to see that. And then we're also looking to expand the medicine side to bring in the medicines that are prescribed through GPs, not just those that are reimbursed by the state through our primary care reimbursement services. So it'll very much be a gradual piece of work as we get better systems in. I mentioned our national immunization system. We're currently working to get all of our vaccinations on there. So at the moment, if your COVID vaccine, your flu vaccine, those all come through to the app at the moment, but to give other vaccines. And you alluded earlier to another feature that we're doing some work on, which is more complex, where perhaps you're the guardian for someone, be it a child, be it an elderly parent, and you want to see their information. So how do we build that feature into the app. And we're looking at international experience here as well. So we've England have done a lot of work in this in probably a more complex landscape than ours, you know, with multiple systems of choice and so on behind the scenes in their hospitals and community. And we're taking some guidance from them because they're further on. So we're looking at learning from other countries. The other aspect is the One Health record, when we implement that, will undoubtedly, we're not going to try and build this all ourselves. Part of that will be to bring some of the capability to actually interact, to cancel appointment, to be automatically rescheduled. AI will undoubtedly start to play a part here over the next 5 years as well as we roll that out. We've seen some examples, a session I was at here this morning, where patients are able to come in Canada, in Ontario, and actually talk to an avatar who's actually able to talk them through their pre-hospital preparation in terms of going in for surgery or indeed to reschedule their appointment. So there's a lot of really interesting technology that will be able to support and assist patients going forward. Our priority is to let this evolve, number one, but also build up the foundational systems, Jess, that really allow you to grow that then and build that and truly deliver it right across the country, because that has been our challenge, where we haven't had these national solutions in place, which means that actually, depending on where you live, you may be able to get more information or interact in a better way than perhaps someone living in another area.
What's the timeline then for this to become a reality, even in that phased basis? What are we looking in terms of time?
Well, like I said, every year we're rolling out three releases. So if I give you an example, like we're increasing the number of hospitals this year, breast screening is going to be added on in terms of appointments. And we're also going to look at the other screening programs. Cervical screening is through general practice, so that's slightly different. And we're looking to grow the services that are there each year. So this isn't going to be a big bang. Every year we'll have three releases. Every year we'll continue to grow it. The reason I'm linking it to our One Health Record program is as that starts to get deployed, where we have truly have a full electronic health record in all our services, that opens up enormous potential. I mentioned earlier in our maternity hospitals, where over recent years there's been phenomenal work done by our maternity services and our team implementing the electronic health record, we're now looking at how we could make the patient's information available to them through the app and or through a portal, so they can actually see their own information, all of their own information that's held in the hospital system about them. And that's really important in terms of transparency, but also supporting the woman on her journey through pregnancy and linking that in perhaps then using AI and other things to relevant information that might be appropriate to their pregnancy. So there's a lot of potential once you have that core information in the background, Jess, and it's held in a consistent, standardized way. That gives us massive potential. So this isn't going to be one big bang. It's gradually going to evolve over the next number of years. And our aim is to have at least three releases a year with new capability, new functions and new data for the public.
My final question relates to security and the integrity of the data, because again, we know that that is of paramount concern. I assume that security and secure checks are ingrained into every single element of this.
Yeah, it's built in by design, Jess. So there's a couple of levels to that. The first thing is to access your information on the app. You must have a government ID, which is the government authentication service. So that's the most secure form of access for any digital information that you're going to access in the state. And that's really important. And you'll have seen Minister Chambers talk recently under some consultation about the government wallet. Again, the government ID will be the input to that also. So that's number one. So that's really important. Separately then, in terms of our Chief Information Security Office that's built up over recent years, post the cyber attack that the HSE had many years ago, a huge amount has been invested in that area. And again, there's a process that every application has to go through to be certified from a cybersecurity perspective. That doesn't guarantee everything. We know that risk is there. So the monitoring of that is constant, Jess, in relation to the security and authentication of people who access it. And the last point I'd make on that is the data then is really important, because, again, if people get the data and it doesn't make sense, that could potentially cause not just trust issues, but also practical issues for patients. So there's a lot of work going on to make sure that the data is as clean as possible. And certainly for key clinical information, that's vital. And that also means, back to the point I made earlier, when you're looking at the hospital appointments, a lot of our work was actually trying to standardise the workflow, standardise the data, so that the way things are recorded and done in Letterkenny is the same
as in North Dublin or in Cork or Kerry or wherever. And that's actually probably the biggest chunk of work, Jess, is to get that
standardisation of data, standardisation of process. So ultimately, when patients get their information, it makes sense to them wherever it's come from.
Great stuff. Well, Damien, I hope you might come back in a few months' time and we'll do a bit of an update check and follow the progress of this. As you said, many people have already downloaded the app. I have it here on my phone in front of me. You can find it. It's free on both Android and iOS. Just search for HSE and you will see it there. Damien, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining me here on News Talk.
Thank you, Jess.
That was Damien McCallion, Chief Technology and Transformation Officer and Deputy CEO of the HSE. If you've downloaded the app, I'd love to know your experience with it. As I say, I have it on my phone and thankfully, touch wood, etc., I don't have too much interaction with the health service on behalf of myself. So I haven't felt the full impact of it, but if you have and you found it good, bad and different, whatever it is, let me know how you go. techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address. We'll be right back. techtalk@newstalk.com, as ever, is the email address if you want to get in touch, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. We're going to jump into that inbox in a few minutes and answer some of your tech questions, so do get them into me. But before that, I want to look back at WWDC, which took place on Monday. This is thought to be the last hurrah for Tim Cook, who is stepping down as CEO in September. He's being replaced by John Ternus, who's been at the company for a very long time. We didn't hear from John at this event. It was kicked off in the usual style, beautifully produced, pre-recorded package from the Apple campus. Here is how Tim Cook started it.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today at Apple Park and welcome to WWDC. Today, we're looking forward to sharing some exciting announcements, including our latest advancements in Apple Intelligence and Siri. On a personal note, some of the greatest highlights of my time as CEO have been events like this, sharing powerful new tools with all of you and then seeing what you create with them has been a constant reminder that imagination has no limits. Over the years, you have helped people connect, create, learn, and experience the world in extraordinary new ways. And with the incredible capabilities we introduced today, and so many more still to come, I truly believe the best is still ahead. At Apple, creating the best products in the world to deliver experiences that enrich people's lives has always been our North Star. It's been the honor of a lifetime to help advance that mission with teams whose creativity, care, and conviction continue to make a lasting difference in people's lives.
From there, they went through a number of changes that are going to happen to the iOS on your phones, things that will improve app loading speed and some of the compatibility issues that have existed over the last little while. We also got an update on some of the child safety tools and child accounts.
Let's talk about trust and safety. This year, we're taking a big step, expanding our child safety features with powerful and intuitive tools.
And most important step is to create a child account. It immediately enables safeguards across the system, tailored to their age. A child account also provides access to powerful parental controls. We focused on tackling the things parents are most concerned about, like what content our kids can see, who they're allowed to talk to, when kids have access, and how parents can guide their kids' digital journey.
But it wouldn't be a tech event in 2026 without a good amount of talk about AI. We got introduced to what the world really was clamming out for, which is another AI agent. This is Siri AI.
We've rebuilt Siri with powerful AI at the core. And today we're introducing an entirely new version of Siri, unlocked by Apple Intelligence. We call it Siri AI. So Siri is now a profoundly more capable assistant that helps you find what you need and gets more done. It's also more conversational, new dedicated Siri app. And not only that, now Siri offers helpful visual intelligence across platforms, along with integrated tools so you can write and edit with Siri virtually anywhere you type.
Some of the features of Siri AI are very cool. There are also going to be AI upgrades and enhancements to the camera. There's going to be intelligent photo editing tools. There's also a spatial reframing that I really like the look of.
we have a deep respect for the craft of photography. And so our goal for bringing AI into the Photos app is to help photographers enhance their images in ways that respect the original moment. We have three features to help make your compositions frame-worthy. First, the popular cleanup tool is getting a big upgrade. So you can remove distractions with better quality and more realistic infill. Sometimes you wish you had a little more space around your subject, or you need a different aspect ratio for a project. Now you can expand your images with the Extend tool to give your subjects more breathing room. Now, with spatial reframing, you can fix all these things after the photo was taken. Here I'll find all the editing features that use our Apple Intelligence image models and private cloud compute, including spatial reframing.
So there are some of the cool things that Apple unveiled at WWDC the other day. However, within minutes of that event ending, an article appeared up on the Apple press website in their newsroom feature. And the headline of this post is, due to DMA, Siri AI delayed in EU for iOS 27 and iPad OS 27. So the DMA is the Digital Markets Act. The post reads, Apple today introduced Siri AI, an entirely new version of Siri powered by Apple Intelligence. Unfortunately, due to the Digital Markets Act, Apple will not be able to ship Siri AI in the European Union with the release of iOS 27 and iPad OS 27. Over the past several months, EU regulators did not accept any of Apple's proposed solutions to bring Siri AI to the EU while safely supporting other virtual assistants. Craig Federighi, who's Apple's Senior Vice President of Software Engineering, said, we're deeply disappointed that our EU users won't have Siri AI on iPhone or iPad when we share our new software releases later this year. Our hope is to eventually bring Siri AI to the EU, and we will continue to engage with EU regulators on a path forward. However, their refusal to engage constructively on solutions that preserve privacy and security mean we do not currently have a timeline for Siri AI's availability in the EU. Now, that is a fairly strongly worded statement from Apple. This is not the first time that we've encountered issues with big tech not being able to roll out features that they want in the EU. But what's fascinating is that on Tuesday, an EU digital affairs spokesperson named Thomas Rayner has come out and completely refuted what Apple has said. He says, and I quote, the decision not to roll out Siri AI in the EU is Apple's and Apple's only, because absolutely nothing in the DMA prohibits Apple from introducing new products in the EU. He continued by saying Apple was simply unable to develop interoperability solutions that meet essential EU privacy and security standards. He then said that Apple sought an exemption from that rule, and he said that an exemption was not an option because it would mean favouring Apple's Siri on its own products. Other AI agents wouldn't have an equal chance to be chosen by iPhone users. This is one to watch. It's not the sexiest tech story that we've ever heard of. It's not the most fascinating, but it is consequential. This goes back to what we were talking about on the show last week in terms of balancing the seesaw of innovation and regulation, how it can be done, if Europeans will be left behind. The message here from Apple is, like, the frustration is palpable. But personally speaking, as a tech fan, yes, I want access to the technology, but I also want the big tech companies to play by the rules. These rules have been brought in to make the internet safer and more equal and a better experience for us, the users, and us, the EU citizens. So surely the buck stops with the big tech companies to find a way to make it work. I don't know. Let me know what you think. TechTalk@newstalk.com. Would this put you off sticking with your iPhone? Would you consider moving to Android? Or let's just call a spade a spade. Have you already found the AI system that works for you at this stage? Is Apple just too late to the game? TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address. Right, when we come back here on News Talk, I'll answer your tech questions. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Off the Ball will be along in just a quick minute. But before that, we have a bit to get through. I'm going to answer some of your tech questions in a few minutes, but I also have some recommendations for you. The first of which is the hour-long interview Scott Pelley did with the New York Times in the wake of his firing from 60 Minutes on CBS. If you're not instantly familiar with the name Scott Pelley, I imagine you would recognise him. Do a quick Google there. I've watched so many of the 60 Minute reports on YouTube over the years. They have been central in terms of taking viewers to stories that perhaps they didn't fully comprehend. Maybe they showcase a different side of the story. Maybe they introduce you to the people behind the headlines. Their reporting has been significant and important over a long period of time. But Scott Pelley was recently fired from the station after significant editorial disagreements and what he alleges interference. He claims the management team put pressure on the program staff to push elements of the government's agenda or narrative. It's a very emotional and compelling interview, which I watched in full on YouTube the other day. But you'll also find it in the New York Times daily feed, the podcast feed. Here's just a snippet of the interview.
What do you hope your departure does? What do you hope will happen now?
My hope is that the leadership of Paramount will say to themselves, okay, this isn't working. We have respected journalists saying that there is a thumb on the scale for one political party over another. And there's a subtle political bias that I've never seen at 60 Minutes before or at CBS News before. We can save this. It's possible to land this plane. But right now, CBS News, in my view, is on fire.
Yeah, that's Scott Pelley speaking with the New York Times. And I would recommend you watch the entire thing because it shows so many different aspects as to what's going on, particularly with media in the United States at the moment. That term that he uses about, you know, it being on fire, and he says repeatedly throughout the interview, and he alleges repeatedly throughout the interview that there was a thumb on the scale, essentially that, you know, there was influence for the government or the president's narrative to appear on the program. It impacted the editorial independence of that news desk, which is obviously massively concerning. And I think if you look at what else has happened over the last few months, you know, as we spoke about last month, Stephen Colbert finishing up, the interference that happened with Jimmy Kimmel being taken off the air, it is massively concerning. And again, during that interview, Scott Pelley does say that, you know, you can't have a democracy without a free press. It's a huge component of it. So I have to say I was moved at times during the interview, but very, very interested in what he had to say and concerned indeed about what he had to say. So that's one recommendation. Elsewhere on my list of recommendations this week is the latest book from Irish author Louise O'Neill. It's called Whatever Happened to Madeleine Stone. And I don't mind telling you that I inhaled this book. It reminded me a bit of the book I mentioned on the show a few weeks ago, I'm Glad My Mom Died, which is it's an autobiography of an actor who was pushed into acting from a very young age, and it tells her story and how getting into that world from a very young age impacted her relationships with her family, with her friends, with her partners, with herself. Very compelling. So this is kind of like a fictionalized take on it. I hoovered it up. It is just a pure joy to read. It's the ideal summary read book. There are twists, there are turns, there are multiple timelines in place. And when you finish it, you do walk away thinking about it afterwards, which in my opinion is always a sign of a good book. So if you haven't read it already, get your paws on it. It is Whatever Happened to Madeleine Stone by Louise O'Neill. As I always say, I'm forever on the hunt for things to read, watch and listen to. So if you have any recommendations for me, get them into me now, techtalk@newstalk.com. A few people were on to me via that email address, flagging that I did mention my mini marathon experience with the Fitbit Air last week on the show, and then I didn't talk about it. And you are dead right. It completely went out of my brain. The clock got away from me last week. So thank you for copying that. What I would say is, for those of you who don't know, maybe you missed the show a few weeks ago, and you can listen back on the Go Loud app, just search for Tech Talk. But Google has brought out a new fitness wearable that some people have been calling the Whoop Killer, because it's not a smartwatch, it's just a smart band. And there's an app, a new health app that has AI built into it. And the idea is that it's giving you deeper insights into everything that you do and then giving you actionable takeaways from that data, a la Whoop. So I've been wearing both the Whoop and the Fitbit Air over the last little while. And 2 weeks ago now, I did the VHI Women's Mini Marathon in aid of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. And I had both on. And I've been so disappointed by the Google Fitbit Air, to the point where I was thrilled that I'd had the Whoop. Because again, it's just the smallest little things. So for example, after I finished the mini marathon, I opened Whoop and it told me my the time that I did it in. It told me my heart rate. It gave me all the usual insights that it gives. Then on the Fitbit Air, the app was just giving me wrong data the entire time. It was telling me that there was no heart data recorded. It was telling me that I'd only run for 15 minutes when in fact I'd done 10 kilometers, which I'm not fit enough to do it in 15 minutes. I can tell you that now. And so I just couldn't rely on and trust the information that it was putting out there. And since the mini marathon, I'm still using both because, in my opinion, you kind of have to have a longer review period with a device like this because it does learn your habits over time. I'm still frustrated. So, for example, it's telling me that I slept for 2 hours and 24 minutes on Tuesday, which is just not correct at all. So the message that I woke up to on Wednesday morning was, that was a rough night, Jess. Getting only 2 hours, 24 minutes of sleep is going to make today a grind, especially with that time zone jump. I haven't moved time zone. I didn't sleep for 2 hours, 24 minutes. I don't understand why it's getting these things wrong. It's not like I'm misusing the app or I'm trying to trick the app or the wearable at all. I literally have it on my wrist and forget about it. So that is frustrating. I would say that I do like the auto exercise tracking. I think it is good at that. But I find myself getting increasingly annoyed at the inaccurate information that the AI is putting out there. And it really peeved me, for want of a better phrase, that it fails to correctly log my 10K mini marathon, because I wanted to do the side-by-side comparison and it just didn't log it correctly. So I'm not giving up on it entirely yet. As I say, I've got the Whoop on my left arm and the Fitbit Air on my right arm. But I like, my brother's texting me every other day asking me, should I get the Fitbit Air because it's 99 quid? And I'm consistently telling him, hold off, don't buy it yet, because I'm not 100% sold. And that's what I would say to you. So that was my experience with the Fitbit Air at the VHI Women's Mini Marathon. If you've bought one and maybe you've had a different experience, let me know. techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address. And speaking of that email address, let's jump in and answer some of your tech questions. First up this week is from Georgina, who says, hi, I'm looking at Remarkables. I want something I can use to take notes. I'm writing a novel, wow, with no backlight. Do you know anything about Remarkable? Would you recommend it or an alternative? Yes, Georgina, I've actually been testing the Remarkable over the last few months now at this stage. And I think it would be ideal for your situation. It's very simple in that there are no distractions. It kind of just does what it says on the tin to a certain extent. It's a digital notebook. There's no faffing around. You can sync it so that the files go up to the cloud so you can access them from another device. The handwriting recognition is excellent. Like, I've been so impressed by it. And I would have fairly neat childlike handwriting anyway, but I've tried, you know, writing during meetings, doodling, all the rest. The recognition is very, very good. The Remarkable is expensive. I don't know if I personally would buy one for what it is that I do day to day, week to week and all the rest. But for what it is that you're doing, I think it is the perfect device for you. So I would recommend it. I've been testing the Remarkable too. Really like it, and I do think it would tick the boxes for you. So go for it. Let me know how you get on, and also let us know when your novel comes out as well. Very exciting. Best of luck. Next up, we have an email here from Ronnie who says, just heard the end of your News Talk feature on refurbished phones. You mentioned a reliable supplier in Sandyford, but I didn't catch the name. I have an iPhone 12 Pro on which it is very hard to see the screen in sunlight. Battery is 82% capacity. Do they take trade-ins? Ronnie, thank you very much for your email. So the company that I mentioned that's based in Sandyford is mintplus.ie. Let me just check. I don't know if they do trade-ins. I don't think so. Let me just double check here now. Please hold the line, caller. No, as far as I can see, they don't. Now, you can, there are other outlets that you can go to get a trade-in. I think, and you can, I'm just doing it here now again, on refurbed.ie and on swappy.ie, you can sell your phone. So even if you wanted to buy a new phone from from mintplus.ie, you could then sell your current phone to refurbed or to swappy. And it depends on the condition and all the rest. That'll dictate how much money you get. So I do hope that helps. But again, the place that I'd recommend buying from is mintplus.ie. The final question, and we are up against the clock, so the final question is from Niamh. Wonder if you could help, please. My 18-year-old son is interested in getting an iPhone 13. Is it worth the investment? More expensive than the Samsung phones he's had over the years, but he's keen to change. Also, what refurbed suppliers would you recommend? Anything else he should bear in mind before he makes the decision? So the jump from Android, so a Samsung phone, to an Apple phone isn't as big a deal as it used to be. It's very easy to make the transition in terms of your content and all the rest. The thing that I would say to check is whether or not all the apps he uses on his Samsung would be available on the Android store, or sorry, the other way around, if all the apps he uses on his Android would be available on the iPhone store. For the most part, they tend to be. It's just if there's anything in particular. I'm looking here now again on Mint Plus, and they have an iPhone 13 128 gig for €349, which is a good price. I still do think the iPhone 13 is worth a look. I think the 13 and the 14 is as far as I would go, as if I was buying a new iPhone. I wouldn't bother with the 15 or the 16. So yeah, go for it. And as I said, just make sure that the apps that he uses are available. But yeah, treat yourself. I hope that helps. Right, that is it from me this week. If you've missed any of the show, listen back in full on the Go Loud app. Just search for Tech Talk. You'll find all the bits and pieces there. I'll be back with Anton Savage on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.